Welcome to Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Coming up on today's show, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice has secured funding to create the Environmental Justice Data Hub. It's meant to supply more granular data about pollution and the communities it affects. We'll ask what they hope that data hub will do for some communities in Louisiana. But first, the Inflation Reduction Act. President Joe Biden recently signed it into law. Among the many things it attempts to address is the climate, particularly through energy policy. I wanted to ask an expert about the environment and climate part of that legislation, in specific how it affects Louisiana, and our guest today had some insights in a recent editorial he wrote in The Advocate. We'll link to it in our podcast for the show. To answer some questions about this, we have Joshua Bashichis, Assistant Professor in Environmental Studies and Public Policy at Tulane University. Welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thanks for having me.
So the Inflation Reduction Act, it does a lot of things. This energy and climate policy is just a part of it. Can you get us up to speed on what the legislation tries to do to address climate change and clean energy?
Sure. And the first thing I want to say about it is just how historic it is in nature. This is literally the first federal piece of climate legislation. We have had Clean Air Act and other federal statutes that have been used to address climate change. But this is the first piece of legislation that has passed both the House and the Senate in Washington, D.C., that is specifically targeting towards reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. So what the bill basically does is it takes an incentive-based or subsidy-based approach. Unlike prior attempts like the Waxman-Markey bill of 2009 and 10, which sought to directly regulate carbon-intensive industries, this bill essentially appropriates a large amount of federal dollars to the order of several hundred billion dollars to various clean energy programs and priorities through a number of mechanisms, including tax credits for utilities and energy providers who are trying to build large-scale renewable energy projects. There are tax credits in this bill that will help them do that and make those projects more competitive relative to fossil fuel projects. And then there's also consumer-facing money to help individual people better afford things like electric vehicles, heat pumps, which is an electric way to heat your home, and other ways to reduce individuals' carbon footprints.
It sounds like a lot of money going out, but is it a bill that was designed to get money back into the federal budget to pay for itself?
So there are pay-fors in the bill, basically having to do with corporate tax increases. I'm not an expert on that aspect of the bill, but yes, there's efforts to pay for this, for these funds, yes.
And you said that the bill is a carrot-based approach as a budget bill rather than a regulatory bill. You kind of made that distinction. So we could do a regulatory bill in the federal government if we wanted to, but we didn't this time. What's behind that?
Right. Well, I think, you know, you have to use that word could very carefully because I'm not sure it was politically feasible. One of the reason why this bill is the way it is, essentially, is because per the rules of the United States Senate, which has always been the more difficult body in order to pass legislation, a budget reconciliation bill of this kind only requires 50 votes, plus the vice president would be the tie-breaking vote. So another approach that would have involved direct regulation per the rules of the Senate would have required a filibuster-proof majority of 60 votes. And so, you mean, there's a number of reasons. I mean, academics will argue about the merits, and especially economists will argue with political scientists about whether it's better to incentivize versus penalize. But from a purely political point of view, the reason it was done this way is because it only required 50 votes to pass.
I see. So then this bill is all carrot, no stick. Does it have any teeth?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define teeth, but it is certainly likely to make a significant impact. I'm not a modeler. I don't model greenhouse gas emissions. So in that sense, it's hard to imagine the bill not having an impact. However, if by teeth you mean penalties for companies that choose not to take advantage of these incentives or a direct mechanism to ensure in the statute that the emission reductions are achieved, then no. In that sense, it does not have teeth. But it is a significant amount of money that if you believe in the economy and the, you know, the free market to to change things, then it's hard to imagine this not dramatically altering the economic priors so that renewables are not only competitive, but significantly more economically beneficial than traditional sources of energy.
We're speaking with Joshua Bassiches, Assistant Professor in Environmental Studies and Public Policy at Tulane University's School of Liberal Arts. He's helping us analyze the Inflation Reduction Act, a budget-based approach at climate and energy regulation. You mentioned that the bill is based very much on the mechanism of what the states decide to do, how the states decide to regulate, and that this is a process influenced by political forces on the state level. Can you tell me about the dynamics there?
Exactly. And so this is where my expertise, because my own research focuses heavily on politics and policymaking that occurs in state houses. So in places like Baton Rouge, Sacramento, California, Boston, Massachusetts, these places that we often in the national media don't think about as sites where major policy is made. So I think one of the points that I've been trying to explain to people about this law is that it is very much reliant on the decision-making of state agencies, and in particular, public service commissions or public utility commissions, which are the agencies that basically set electricity rates for consumers. They set the rates that utilities such as Entergy in Louisiana are allowed to charge us when we pay our electric bills. There's a whole set of policies that goes into that calculation that involves how expensive or inexpensive the underlying energy is. And then there's also a lot of considerations for utilities in terms of, you know, this bill, it makes it easier to add renewable capacity. But the other side of that coin is how quickly we can phase out the fossil fuel capacity. And all of those decisions, the federal legislation is silent on. And so that's where state houses and specifically these state agencies that regulate electricity become so important.
So speaking of the state level, let's talk about where we are, Louisiana. How do you see Louisiana reacting to the energy and climate portions of this bill? We are a big energy state after all.
You know, I'll be honest, I can say that Louisiana is going to be an especially difficult state to implement this in line with what the proponents in Washington were imagining. And the reason, there's a number of reasons why. The legislature is a, you know, traditional red state, and I put that in quotes, legislature, and the commissioners who make these decisions, it's unclear sort of where their politics are. From a purely economic standpoint, because Louisiana is such a high fossil fuel producing state, one of the highest in the country, there's a lot of local economic considerations in terms of employment and things like that, that will also go into these decisions. So this will certainly matter for Louisiana. It will certainly change the calculus, but it won't necessarily change the entire state's economy, certainly not overnight.
Yeah, certainly not overnight. Of course, the argument out there against, you know, reducing fossil fuels is that we have a lot of jobs there, and where do those jobs go? Do you see much consensus as to whether the renewables will create that job economy here in Louisiana like we depend on fossil fuels for?
You know, it is difficult to say. You know, there's certainly a lot of jobs when it comes to, for example, rooftop solar. There's a tremendous number of jobs in terms of the people that go to your homes, that install the solar panels. So to suffice it to say, there are a significant number of green jobs that are going to be created by policies like this. That being said, a promised job in the future is never the same as a job that is currently being occupied. So just because this will create a lot of jobs doesn't mean it's going to make it any easier for those currently working in the fossil fuel industry. Though we'll need additional policies to transition those folks.
And with that state house dynamic, Louisiana is a net inward state as far as the flow of federal tax money leaving the state and then coming back. More comes back to Louisiana from the federal government. Do you think that might affect the palatability of measures like this?
Yeah, I think that should. I mean, that's really going to be The Biden administration, particularly the agencies that are going to be doling out these funds, hopefully are considering the fact that not all states are equal when it comes to the revenues that they have available. But it's definitely worth thinking about whether some of the money can be targeted more so to a state like Louisiana than a state like California, which already has a lot of dollars in its, in the system for renewables.
Having mechanisms that are very much based on whether people, whether businesses, industry, whether states decide to take advantage of these incentives or not, there's a question as to whether it happens or not. Is this bill likely to reach its goals? That might be a criticism, after all, that this is a big spend with no guaranteed return.
I think there's likely to be a big return. I mean, you get into the specifics. You know, when we talk about goals, are we talking about, greenhouse gas emissions globally? Are we talking about, additional megawatts of renewable electricity? I mean, there's a lot of ways to determine, what a policy's goals are and then to assess whether they are met. So, will it achieve every objective that its most optimistic proponents have been selling us on? Probably not. But will it make a significant difference? And will we be able to point to things that wouldn't have happened but for this investment? Absolutely. I'm very confident we will. This is a big step forward for climate change. It's just not sufficient. I think that's the key point here.
Not sufficient.
Well, just in the sense that the way our energy system is set up, it relies on decentralized decision making. So there's nothing that the federal government could do without the cooperation of states and localities that would be sufficient. So it's not necessarily a criticism of the law in so much as it's a reality of the way energy is governed in the United States.
Joshua Bashichis, Assistant Professor in Environmental Studies and Public Policy at Tulane University. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks, Adam. It's my pleasure to talk to you.
From WWNO and WRKF, this is Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Late last month, the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice announced that it received a $500,000 grant to create what it's calling the Environmental Justice Data Hub. It will be an interactive online portal that will provide environmental justice organizations with research information on their communities. Our guest today says they hope this data will be more granular and better represent communities most affected by environmental issues. To tell us more about the Environmental Justice Data Hub, we have Monique Hardin, Assistant Director of Law and Policy at the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. Welcome to Louisiana Considered.
Thank you for inviting me.
First of all, tell me a little bit about the Environmental Justice Data Hub. It's a new thing. What information is it looking for, and how will this information be helpful?
Well, the Environmental Justice Data Hub sets out to do something that is innovative and that ground truthing the lived experience that environmental justice communities have with racially disproportionate pollution burdens. So we're talking about frontline communities that are in close proximity to power plants, oil refineries, waste sites, you name it. And we've got a lot of communities in that situation, unfortunately, here in Louisiana. And so what this data hub would do would be an educational and awareness raising tool where residents could get firsthand information about how they're being impacted by environmental conditions where they live. This would also be a data hub that would be advised by other community-based organizations here in the Gulf Coast region, and with a team of people that includes researchers at HBCUs here in Louisiana and throughout the Gulf Coast region.
So it sounds like the collection and analysis of this data might be independent from government agencies and polluters and industry players then?
It would be. It would be a first of its kind data hub in terms of being able to use data that's at the community level. So if you look at, for example, an EPA air pollution monitoring report for criteria pollutants like nitrous oxides or sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, for example, you might see whole swaths of areas here in Louisiana that are considered healthful. And you know, like, this can't be helpful because I know of all of the pollution and taking place in this particular area. But the scale that EPA draws from is so large geographically that it really obscures the toxic hotspots where our communities are living. And so this would be a data hub that would reflect that lived experience, lived reality, and so that communities can then begin to use that data to make the case for change to improve their communities.
So what this data hub is acknowledging is that granularity of your data, the specificness of the geography is important, and actually the validity of the data and how much information you get out of it. It probably takes some resources to get that specific of data.
That's right. So with this particular project we have, the Environmental Justice Data Hub, it involves about 1 year of planning to make sure we've got the right tools, the right people, the right research that would go into building the data hub. And so this would be bringing together in a collaborative partnership, community-based organizations and environmental science researchers and people who are data hubs of software engineers together to begin to build this environmental justice data hub. We're really excited about the potential it has for breaking through some of the roadblocks that are in the way of communities who are really demanding better for themselves and future generations because the data is not there to back them up.
We're speaking with Monique Hardin, Assistant Director of Law and Policy at the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice. We're talking about the Environmental Justice Data Hub. Primarily, who will use this data hub?
Folks who we have in mind to benefit our community-based organizations that are fighting for environmental justice. We think this would also be very important for researchers and people working in climate policy arena and climate solutions, especially those with a focus around ensuring equity and how we go about this, the challenge of the climate crisis and pollution in general. We also hope it will help to inform decision makers at the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, as well as other state agencies and federal agencies that are, kind of coming together to figure out how to ensure environmental protection in Black and other communities of color who have, for decades, have suffered from industrial pollution.
When will this project be rolled out? What's the time frame here?
We just started. We just received the money, and we just started with the planning process that goes on for about a year, bringing and recruiting people into the process. And then we're hoping to get the hub up and running by year two.
You talked about people. It sounds like a project like this would take a lot of resources to get your hands on this data and to process it. What kind of resources does this take?
Well, it takes resources in terms of connecting with communities on the ground about their lived experience and what they would like to see in a data hub that can serve their interests as part of their work for improving environmental conditions where they live, improving community health and wellness. So that would be a process that we're now beginning with on September 21st this month, reaching out and talking to community-based organizations here in Louisiana and in the Gulf Coast region, as well as in other parts of the United States.
Now, we know that Louisiana is somewhat unique in the impact and the stratification of the impact that environmental issues have on communities. Are there any other models, any other examples across the nation of this sort of data hub?
We're not aware of a data hub that is informed by community-based organizations. And so the work that we do at the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice is all centered on the community model, which brings researchers and communities together in an equitable partnership where communities are able to lead and drive solutions that make sense for them and are, supported in building their capacities to have a say in being self-determined where they live. This data hub moves along the same way, where we want the building and the development of it and the use of it to be ones that where communities are in the lead and where they're benefited.
So maybe do you think a project like this in Louisiana could serve as a template or an influence on how environmental data is collected in other communities nationwide?
We hope it will. We hope it will catch on so that more databases that have very important environmental information can also include community impacts and community voices.
Monique Hardin, Assistant Director of Law and Policy at the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice, thank you for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me.
This is Louisiana Considered. When Cullman County, Alabama was founded in 1873, it was advertised as a place with, quote, no blacks and no Indians. Its largest city was a sundown town. But one of the oldest communities in Cullman County was a safe haven for black people in the state, and in some ways still is. WBHM's Kira Miles talked to residents of Colony about its rich history.
On a hot summer day in August, hundreds of people gather in Colony, Alabama for an annual town reunion and homecoming.
Oh, hey, you! How you doing?
Kids giggle their way through outdoor games and hamburgers sizzle on the grill. It's everything you want from a Southern cookout. They call the celebration Colony Day, and longtime resident Inez Malcolm looks forward to it.
We really enjoy our community, and a lot of people from different areas, they don't believe that black people live in Cullman County. And we do. You know, we coincide with everybody, and everybody gets along.
A lot of people here call the town the Colony, and residents say to live here is to embrace the simple life. Kids play freely in the woods, and neighbors always share with one another.
Nobody in my community will ever go hungry, because there's always somebody that knows somebody.
On Colony Day, everyone honors their shared history. Colony was settled by formerly enslaved people in the mid-19th century on land that wasn't known for being very fertile. Since white settlers didn't want the land they lived on, the colony was largely left alone. And black farmers were able to work their land, make money, and eventually buy their plots. Robert Davis, who's a history professor at Wallace State Community College in Cullman County, says it was a place where you could be black without fear, especially in the early 1900s.
The black community in Cullman County owned more land than any other community. They had their own stores, their own mills, their own schools, the whole nine yards.
When Colony was established, it was not originally in Cullman County. They weren't welcome. Davis says there were no black people, or at least very few in the county. And the county's largest community, also called Cullman, was a sundown town. But at some point, Davis says mines opened on local coal deposits, bringing jobs and money for black laborers in the colony. And Cullman County leaders wanted in.
And you can't bring Stout Mountain and the coal mines in unless you also bring in the colony.
Combining the area's oldest black town and a known anti-black county could have been a recipe for disaster.
Cullman had a terrible reputation.
That's Earlene Johnson, one of Colony's oldest residents.
They said blacks were afraid to come through Cullman. Even on the train said they would pull the shades down when they rode through Cullman.
But Johnson says the relationship between the town and the county was more complicated than that. She says there were racial tensions between the colony and the rest of Cullman, but it wasn't as bad as in other parts of Alabama. Johnson went to college in Montgomery.
And I was in school doing the marches when Reverend King and all and Rosa Parks were riding the bus, and I was in college by then. We did not have that kind of fight going on, you know, struggle going on where they put dogs and what have you.
She says residents of the colony were largely self-sufficient, so they didn't need to go into Cullman often. But when they did, it was fine. After college, when she moved back to Colony, she became a teacher and later mayor. Johnson says she applied for any and every grant to get Colony a library and a town hall building. Her team's work to grow Colony led to the town's official incorporation in 1981. Johnson, who is now 84, says she hopes a new generation can continue to build up the colony. Back at Colony Day, Jasmine Cole is wearing a t-shirt that says Team Colony, Lifetime Member. She's 27, and she says she was inspired by Johnson when she was a young girl to continue building up the colony.
So I was more just following her footsteps, trying to get the colony back live again. Because it was like withering away.
Cole is the town's youngest council member, and she organized the last two Colony Day celebrations in hopes to keep people coming back.
I'm proud of this area. It's always been a good community, so it means a lot to me. It's my home.
Colony is not a town that is solely defined by its history. is a community of people that supported one another through good and bad times.
That's Kira Miles reporting from WBHM. That's Louisiana Considered. I'm Adam Voss. Thanks for listening.
Major support for Louisiana Considered provided by Rouse's Markets, a Louisiana shopping experience, with additional support from Tulane School of Public Health.